Whether you're an avid reader or a daily writer, this show's for you. Naked Monday with David Temple.
On today's show, you'll get to hear from a self-published author with over 30 titles to his credit. After serving in the Army and military intelligence, and then working as a police officer in Spokane, Washington, Frank retired from the force and now dedicates his time to crafting gritty crime novels. Having held the number one spot for police procedurals on Amazon, Frank shows no signs of slowing down, and there's a lot of behind-the-scenes material to learn about, as well as learning some of his inside secrets to creating such a handsome body of work. So, with that in mind, let's get to it. Please join me in welcoming Frank Zaffiro. Hi, Frank.
Hey, David. How's it going?
Good. Very good. What are you drinking?
I'm drinking Java.
Nice.
Just a basic blend.
I've got a tasty little espresso that's about my fourth one this morning, so I'm feeling very good.
This is about my fourth cup. I've been up since about 6:30 this morning. So,
are you a morning writer or an afternoon writer?
I'm a when I can writer. Really, I kind of developed into that because of having to steal time back when I was on the job. So,
sure,
you know. It was whenever. So I don't really have, I'm not one of those people that sits down from 8 to 10 every day. Maybe I should give that a try. I might be more productive, but.
Yeah. Let me say this for a guy who says may be more productive. I'm looking at you. I spent an hour and a half on your website last night because I've now become completely addicted to Frank. I mean, like I'm reading everything. I'm reading all your, you know, having done radio for 25 years, I like to have just enough information that I don't look like an idiot, which doesn't always work. But then I find myself just like drilling down on this stuff, and I'm fascinated by cops and guys that served in the armed forces, and I wanted to start off my show by saying thank you for your service in both the Army and as a police officer. So
thank you.
Yeah,
that's kind of you to say.
Well, if it wasn't for you guys on the front line, on both of those front lines on any given day, I don't know where the hell our world would be. So hats off to you. If I had one on 30 novels, right? Over 30.
Yeah, it's over 30. I did a count for a different podcast a while back, and I think it was 32 or 33 then. But I mean, don't be too impressed. I cheated on about half of those, and they're collaborations. So I didn't write the whole thing myself.
All right. Now, first of all, I don't know that. I appreciate your honesty. That's very admirable. I think as long as anybody picks up the pen or hits the keyboard in any way, shape, or form, and it gets into the world, it's a plus in your plus column.
And I'll take it.
Yeah.
Take the win.
And I know that you've done, you know, novellas, but a lot of people, you know, there are people who want to poo-poo novellas, but I was on with KJ Howe last week, and she was talking about, you know, between our attention spans getting shorter and the costs of printing getting higher, the stories are getting shorter.
Well, and I'm a firm believer that most ideas have a best natural length. And so, you know, if you try to stretch a short story into a novel, it's not going to work. If you try to pack a novel into a short story, it's not going to work. And so some stories, they fall in that in between land of being more than a short story and less than a novel, hence perfect for a novella. And I agree with you. I think all art forms are good in their own way, and that we should explore them when appropriate. And I mean, I got away from short stories for a while. I was writing just novels for quite some time up until a couple of years ago. And I wish I hadn't done that, because I experienced such joy when I went back and wrote several short stories, and just the positives of that medium just really kind of flooded over me. And I was like, why did I let myself get, you know, pulled away from any one medium, you know?
Why do you suppose you felt that way? Do you think that it's because you were able to have an idea, get in, service it, expand it, and get out without spending months and months, if not years, on a story?
Yeah, well, you know how much effort goes into a novel and how long you're in bed with that novel. You know, it's not a quick romp. It's a weekend in the sack, at least, right? I mean, and so with a short story, there's this, like, you know, well, like when you're writing anything, there's that first blush of that first draft where it's super exciting and you're all wrapped up in the story. And then you get into the editing and stuff, and then it becomes a little bit more work, and it doesn't diminish your love for it, but it's a different sort of love, almost like dating and marriage kind of.
Sure, right? Sure.
A short story is never marriage. A short story is a date, maybe a one night stand, and you never see the person again, you know? And while that sounds a little tawdry in an artistic sense, there is a certain satisfaction. And I think you'd agree to being able to sit down, maybe even one sitting, certainly one sitting as the reader, and read a complete tale that is all wrapped up and finished. And now it's on the shelf and it's done, and that's it. And that's all. And so there's a certain, you know, I mean, sometimes you just want to listen to one song. You don't want to listen to the whole album.
That is a great analogy. It's funny. Yesterday, Frank, I was talking to a neighbor right across the street, and she was telling me she'd just finished my book, and I'd given it to her early summer. She goes, I'm sorry it took so long, but, you know, I was in school and I'm picking it up and laying it down. I said, well, what was your favorite thing about it? She goes, well, oddly enough, I like the fact that your chapters are so short that it just made me kept turning the page. However, the fact I had, you know, I'd pick it up and lay it down, pick it up and lay it down.
Right.
And I thought to myself, that's funny because that's one of the things that I go to. There, in my head, each chapter to me, and I think I'm feeding off to what you're saying, each chapter is like a date. I like this analogy. Mm-hmm. And you're like, hey, I liked that date. And that was fun. We went out, we did this and we did that. And then it was done. And then I come back the next day, and because it's a new scene, oh, it's a new date and I'm having fun in this particular scene. But yeah, I haven't done a lot of novella stuff, but I think I'd like to dip my toe in that because of that very fact. You go, I just want to pick it up, have a couple of chips or a bowl of popcorn and be on my way. I don't have to eat the whole bag.
Yeah, and you can read a novella in one or two sittings, maybe three if you're slow. And I know you've got ideas out there bouncing around in your head that you're like, wow, this would be a really great book if I had one or two more elements, you know, nailed down, or a couple more subplots or characters to explore. And I mean, and if you got something like that, it's almost always a good idea, I think, to pull back and go, well, would this work as a novella? And then I can just keep it stripped down to its core and really dive into it. Yeah. And so, you know, I've written a few and I've really enjoyed them.
I got a lot of different questions, so I'm going to be bouncing all over the place. But you, I was reading one of your reviews. You have some really good reviews. I mean, a stellar stack of reviews. And someone, I don't remember the exact book. I'm sure you're going to pick it out because someone said that.
I've got some pretty bad ones too. I have to interject with that.
All right. Well, don't let me forget this because I want to go off on that tangent. But
back to the good ones.
Some of your good ones were fantastic. And somebody said, any fan of Don Winslow will want to get into your book. And I'm like, I'm the biggest Don Winslow fan there is. And I've got all of his books and I've been able to build a nice friendship with him. And when you have that kind of accolade, especially coming from your background. Now, Don wasn't a cop, but you were a cop, and he was a detective, which brings me to a question. Mm-hmm. And this is going to sound, I'm going to sound like an idiot in one sense, but then I'm just hungry for knowledge. First of all, what did you like better? Did you like being a cop or did you like being a detective? And then which one of those are your favorites and why?
Well, I would make a distinction. I mean, any law enforcement officer, I think, is a cop. That's how I think of them. And I think most cops would say, I'm a cop, I'm a law enforcement officer, regardless of their rank or position. I think, what you're delineating really is a patrol officer versus a detective, uniform versus plain clothes.
Yeah, my bad. Yeah.
No, not at all. Just making sure I'm there. I only spent 2 years as a detective, and you know, and I spent 8 years as a patrol officer before that. So I had a lot more experience as a patrol officer. And this is going to sound like a weaselly answer, but there's really good and bad to each. And like as a patrol officer, you never know what's going to happen next. You could be sitting there having a cup of coffee on a quick break and something could jump off. You could go to a call or make a traffic stop and it goes a completely different direction. There's this, you know, it's never the same thing exactly twice. And it can be a grind like any other job, but that's a neat thing. Also, when the day ends, you drive your car into the station, you turn it over to the next shift or park it or whatever, and you go home. There isn't any work waiting for you while you're gone. Nothing's stacking up waiting for you. You come back, you go out, and whatever's on the radio, you know, in the queue comes firing out at you, but it hasn't been waiting there for you generally. But you're also a slave to that radio. Conversely, as an investigator, as a detective, usually you get to wear plain clothes, which, you know, for some reason, all you want to do is wear that uniform. And then after you've worn it for about 5 years, all you want to do is not wear that uniform. It's a weird dynamic. But as an investigator, you have a lot more freedom to decide how to investigate your case. It's a completely different work because it's slower and more methodical, and you have more control over it. And obviously you're trying to figure out a puzzle more often than not, whereas a patrol officer, you're often diffusing and resolving a crisis of some level or another, a minor crisis to a major crisis that's going on. And so those are kind of the differences. And then the biggest difference on the investigative side is you have 12 files on your desk at the end of the day, and you go home and there's 12 files on your desk when you come in the next morning, and three more waiting in your mailbox for you. And so it becomes almost like Lucy with the chocolates and, type of scenario a little bit. Whereas patrol officer, hey, you're done at the end of the day, and you know, it's a fresh start the next day. So they both have their pros and cons. I really enjoyed the freedom of the investigating, and I really enjoyed the interviews. I felt like that was one of my strong suits. My wife teases me because I am not as good as some people with noticing small details. I could go into the pantry and, you know, where's the salt, Himalayan salt? And she's like, it's on the second shelf. I can't find it. She walks in, you know, here you go.
Right.
You know, how are you a detective?
Yeah.
And I was like, well, I partnered up with people who were good at noticing stuff. And then I interviewed the people and I got them to confess. So, hey, it worked. So,
nice.
So it's really all about picking out the pros and the cons of it and trying to decide. So I couldn't tell you which I enjoyed more. I enjoyed them each for the particular charms that they brought.
You know, you bring up a really good point. My wife and I have this conversation all the time. In my past radio career, it was exactly the same thing. You'd go in, you'd punch the clock, you'd do your show, and you go home. Her job, there's always something stacked up and ready to go and waiting to go. And I think to myself, and she comes home every once in a while, she goes, you know, it'd be really fun if I could just go bag groceries today, because I know I'd walk in, hi, how are you? Paper or plastic? Plastic, fine. Pack, have a nice day and go home.
Yeah. There's no groceries packing up at the check stand waiting for her to come bag them the next morning.
You know? No. Now, have you, I'm famous for two-part questions. Number one, have you always wanted to be a writer, and were you writing while you were an officer?
The answer to both is yes. I knew I wanted to be a writer from a very young age and started writing at a very young age. I think a lot of a good percentage of writers that I know, that it's somewhat the same for them, although writing is one of those professions or one of those hobbies for some that sometimes people come too late in life and they develop it. But I always equate it to somebody who's a musician. You know, they always knew they wanted to play guitar and they just always did. And when they were younger, they weren't very good at it, but they started, you know, learning and getting better. And so, you know, yeah, I've been writing since I was pretty young. Actually thinking about myself as a writer and trying to write a story as a writer, you know, probably as young as 10, you know, definitely by the time I was 13, it was pretty solidified.
Oh, wow.
And then, yeah, when I was on the job, you know, there was a big chunk of time where I wasn't writing fiction, because I was learning new jobs, either the basic job, or I became a training officer, or when I was a corporal, and when I was a detective, and then I became a sergeant. And it was every couple of years, or so, I'd either change positions or then I was promoted. And also I was back in school going and getting my history degree at Eastern Washington University while I was working full time. So I was pretty busy and I was writing a lot. I was writing police reports. I was writing memoranda. I was writing history papers for college, but I wasn't writing any fiction really for a good 7 or 8, maybe 9 years there in the middle of my career. But at the very beginning, a little bit, and then around 2004, really started again in earnest.
Well, I can imagine that wouldn't be that's not terribly unusual. I mean, if you're having to crank out reports at work and then reports and or theses for school, the last thing you want to do is come home and try to flip open the laptop or the desktop and start cranking.
And the last thing you had energy for. I mean, when you were working in the dog days of your radio career where you were really, you know, really working a ton, I don't think you would have wanted to come home and do a podcast on the side. You know, just wouldn't have felt, you wouldn't have the energy for it. Or, and like you said, you wouldn't have had the drive necessarily. Yeah. And luckily around 2004, I was a sergeant at that time. And I ended up in a position running for about 3 years, running the volunteer services unit for our department, which was great because we had like 100+ volunteers that volunteered in a bunch of different programs and just did some tremendous work for the community and the police department. But it was an office job and it was pretty stable and the hours were fairly regular in the police world anyway. I mean, they're pretty irregular if you're a banker, but they're much more regular than what I was used to. And then I was fortunate enough to a friend of mine, my best friend actually, introduced me to Colin Conway, who was another officer who was also getting back into writing, something he had been into as a younger guy. And so our partnership, our friendship started then, and that eventually led to a partnership that we've brokered into a few books.
Okay, well then there's the perfect tee up. And I when I come back to some of your collaborations in a second, but you've collaborated with five different authors, one of them being this Colin Conway. So tell me, first of all, how you guys met. This is, I mean, like there's meeting and then there's going, hey, you want to do this together, which is generally a pretty solo event. That's number one. Number two is, tell me about the Charlie 316 series for my listeners who don't know.
You know, I met Colin basically because my best friend, Brad Halleck, we went through the academy together. We lived together for a while. You know, it was a pretty close friendship. He was working at a day tour job at the time, too. He's working in the traffic unit as an investigator. We go to lunch, you know, we had the ability to, you know, free to go to lunch, you know, together, which is kind of cool. You don't always get that. And he was friends with Colin. He met Colin somehow. I don't remember. But he just drug him along to lunch one day and we started talking and discovered, you know, this happened a few times. And at some point we discovered we were both writers and start talking about it and, you know, kind of tentatively, well, hey, if you ever want me to look at anything, well, yeah, you too, you know, sort of feel each other out a little bit there. And we started exchanging our stories and stuff and it just, you know, went from there, the relationship built and the trust built. And at some point I had written a couple of books in my River City series, which is an ensemble cast procedural series that is, River City is a very thinly veiled Spokane. And he was like, you know, we should try something together. And I was like, yeah, let's give it a try. We didn't really know what we were doing. Sure, let's go for it. So what we came up with was this, let's take two characters and let's have a dual first person narrative in this book. And you write the detective, the cop, that was me. And then Colin wrote the enforcer, the mob enforcer, who was the antagonist. But we're writing both in the first person with alternating chapters. So Tower chapter, Virgil Kelly chapter, back and forth, back and forth, back and forth. And it really worked pretty well because we were kind of only writing half a book and it wasn't truly completely collaborative. It worked pretty well and we buzzed through it pretty quick. And that ended up becoming Some Degree of Murder, which was the first book I ever collaborated with anyone on and first one Colin and I wrote. And I used that style of collaboration with a bunch of my other collaborators for the majority of the books I collaborated on. But then years later, jumping ahead to your second question, a few years ago from now, Colin reached out to me and said, hey, I got this story idea. And he laid it out for me, the bare bones of Charlie 316. He said, hey, when I was on the job, Charlie 316 was my call sign one year. And I always thought it had a cool sound. And it always reminded me of John 3:16, the biblical verse, which is probably one of the two or three best known biblical verses out there. And And he said, you know, it always kind of struck me that what would happen if, you know, a favorite son of the police department in the city got into a politically difficult situation with the city, with the department, you know, sacrifice their beloved son on the altar of public opinion. Wow. And that was kind of the jumping off point for it. And I said, yeah, that's awesome. You know, because we throw ideas back at each other all the time and give each other, you know, I mean, I could point to half a dozen things in his books that I'm directly responsible for and vice versa. And so I thought that's what we were doing a bit. And I was giving him ideas and saying, you know, that's a great idea that you have there and so forth. And he says, hey, why don't you write it with me? I want to get into some things that I don't want to get over my skis on, because he had a 5-year police career as a patrol officer. And then he had kind of a special assignment as well, but I had retired as a captain. So I had gotten some perspective that he wouldn't have been privy to, and he wanted that perspective in the book. And so I said, yeah, let's go for it. So Charlie 316 is about Tyler Garrett, a patrol officer who gets into a shooting that initially doesn't look good because the motorist, the victim, the suspect, whatever you prefer, is shot in the back and there's no gun. And then the other aspect that's a little tricky is there's a race element, only we kind of flip the script here in that Tyler Garrett, the model police officer, is black, and the person that got shot, the suspect, is white, which really makes a lot of sense in Spokane, which is in the 90% white range, certainly high 80s percentage of white people there. And secondarily, because it kind of flips the script on what you see nationally when this event occurs and is controversial. And I think a little bit of our hope was that because it wasn't same old, same oak, because it had a different wrinkle to it, it might give people enough of a hitch to make them think about it a little differently or think about it a little more. So that's a long-winded answer, but I will remind you, it was a two-parter.
You know what? And I don't want to get off on politics and beat that over the head, and because it's an upbeat show, but I have to know what goes through your head when you see some of these situations that you've seen lately. And we could rattle them off one after the other. I guess Floyd is the very first one that comes to my head, but because you came from a world where your life was in a much different situation than ours was. So I can never judge. Look, that was horrific. There are a lot of scenes that we see that are horrific, but I also know that I'm not walking through your shoes. I don't know what it's like to get out of my car in the middle of the night, in the middle of nowhere, and have to pull someone over and be fearing for my life. I can't fathom that. I would be petrified. But I guess my question is, you know, how does this make you feel these days? What you're seeing today, how does it make you feel? And how does it make you feel about incorporating perhaps some of that into these stories?
Well, I'll answer the second question first, because it's an easier answer. And that is, we definitely have incorporated some of this into especially the Charlie 316 series. Initially, the series in the first book was about that, will they sacrifice their favorite son sort of question that I mentioned earlier. Sure. But when we discovered that because we thought we were just going to write a standalone, and when we discovered that we had much more story to tell, and then we started looking at what that story was, it ended up being about what you're talking about to some degree. Mm-hmm. And so definitely, I think I don't think you can write today very responsibly about certainly police procedurals without at least addressing it in some fashion or another. I think it'd be like writing a book set in the summer of 2020 and not talking about COVID-19. I mean, it's too big a thing, too big a part of what is happening in that time frame. As far as how it makes me feel, it's very difficult. It's very conflicting, because you're absolutely right. Most people, they don't know what policing is really like. They don't know really how the the barest of facts about policing because they've never policed. They think they know. My wife's a teacher, and I guarantee you a lot of people think they know a lot about how to teach, and they like to tell her a lot. You know, the reality is they don't really know, you know. I mean, right. it's one of these fallacies. We think we're good at something because we experienced it. You know, I've never made a movie. You have. I shouldn't be trying to tell you how to make a movie. I don't have the slightest clue. And so, but it's a two-way blindness, because what happens in police work, and I never really noticed this or really understood it until after I had retired. And I retired in 2013. It's taken quite some time for a deeper understanding, I think, to settle in, is that while the public at large generally doesn't understand policing, doesn't understand what police officers go through, why they take the precautions that they do, police officers develop a similar sort of blindness as to how what they do and why they do it is being reasonably perceived by a reasonable person in the public. And so because both sides of this equation are kind of blind to the other's perspective, a gulf really begins to develop. And that's been going on in our country for decades. And it's only become, I think, more and more pronounced in recent years. And so whenever I see a police event occur that I see part of on television, my first reaction is, all right, I wasn't there. I don't know all the facts. Mm-hmm. So withhold judgment until you do. And that's always hard to do, because sometimes, you know, violence of any kind, even, you know, legal, lawful, and righteous violence that's being used in a situation is ugly, and people don't like to see it. And it bothers people, and rightfully so. So it's difficult to withhold judgment. But there have been times where even with judgment withheld, the more information that comes out, it's clear that the police officer was very much in the wrong. And then it makes me angry for all the reasons it makes everybody angry. But then the additional reason that the actions of this person is now going to be casting doubt and let's face it, vitriol on the 98% of the other rest of the profession that would never do something like that.
Right.
And so it's been a real, I'll be honest with you, David, it's been a real rough couple of years on that front. Yeah. For me, which might be why we ended up writing about it, you know, as almost a therapy.
So many questions pop up, and I really want to stay away from too many headlines, because quite frankly, I'm a little exhausted by all of them, and I'm really more interested in you and what makes you tick. First of all, are you a Bosch fan?
Oh yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Both the books and the television show.
Yeah. Conley is a friggin' genius and a legend, and Bosch is just friggin' impeccable. Do you find when you're reading somebody and they're not getting the details right, be it a detective or a uniform, does that make you cringe? Does that make you crazy?
Yeah, it does a little bit, but I try to be pretty forgiving in the respect that, you know, police details aren't monolithic. I mean, LAPD did things differently than we did in Spokane, and New York does them differently than both of us. Huh. And, you know, New Orleans is a whole different ball of wax. Sure. And so really the only things that I think are the same that as a police officer, you can kind of get your hackles up about are those very basic level things. Like the one that always bothers me, and it's stupid that it does, but it does, is when a patrol cop or detective gets out of their car or gets into a situation and they draw their weapon and they rack the seat. Now, I know why filmmakers do that. I even know why writers do it. You know, it's dramatic. I get it. But it is so wrong. It disturbs me quite a bit.
Racking, you know, the slide.
Yeah, because that's no police officer rides around with an empty chamber. It's you don't do that. It's,
right.
You may not have time to get your gun out in some situations. You definitely don't want to have to take the time to have to charge it, you know,
yeah,
to rack the slide.
That is funny. And they always do that, don't they? It's like,
yeah, yeah, yeah. Yeah.
I'm like, now, what were you doing 5 minutes ago when you know?
Yeah. I mean, you know, any cop, any detective, they're going to check it before they put it in their holster that day and make sure there's one in the pipe, because that's what you do. Yeah. But I'm pretty forgiving of the other stuff. I think the reverse is more true, though. Like when I watch Bosch, or when I watch a really good show or read a really good book, that's where the details are not only right, but the flavor of it is so bang on perfect, then my admiration really soars much, much more proportionally than my irritation might kick in if people get details wrong.
Yeah. To expose myself a little bit here, my latest book, The Poser, that I released back in May, is about a female detective. And I've gotten a fair share of grief from the point of, first of all, you are never a detective, so what do you know? I've gotten some, that's right, we're going to talk about reviews. I want to write that down because I don't want to forget that. And the other is, how can you write from a woman's point of view? You're not a woman. I'm like, that's why I'm a writer. I'm making this shit up, you know? I watch Bosch and I'm like, I know there's a Hollywoodification aspect about certain things. And, you know, as a researcher and writer, I can only get so many of the details completely dead on. But I love to hear from guys that have lived it. So let's go back to reviews real quick. Do you ever find yourself going to read them, and how important are they to you personally?
Yeah, I do read them. Anybody that says they don't is a liar. You know, they do. I mean, how much they do, that may vary, but everybody takes a look real quick at the very least. You know, I checked through my sales and my customer reviews, every morning as part of my coffee routine.
Yeah.
I just click the page and see. And when there's a new one, I give it a quick read. And it's a nice way to start the day when somebody says, I love this book.
Sure.
And you just deal with it when they don't. A friend of mine, another author, I won't say who, because I didn't ask him if it was okay, but he recently sent me an email and said, oh man, I mean, I've been, because he's been working real hard with marketing and doing some other things. And so more books are getting out there. So more reviews are coming in. He's like, yeah, I'm getting some good reviews, but gosh, these bad ones just hurt. You know, and he sent me a couple of them, and he goes, wow, that's just brutal. And, you know, and I don't get this. And, you know, he's like answering each of them to me, because he can't do it to the person that wrote it, obviously.
Yeah.
And so I went and found, I talked to him about it a bit and just, you know, encouraged him or whatever. And then to give him a little perspective, I went to my first book. The first book is the first River City book, Under a Raging Moon. And in my opinion, easily my weakest book. It was the very first book I wrote.
Yeah.
I wrote the first draft in 1995. And even when I revised it in 2005, 2006, it still had the bones of that first draft in it. And, you know, people who read my work say there's a big jump from book one to book two, and another big jump from book two to book three, you know, in terms of this, the writing craft. And I would agree with that assessment. But, you know, the book has 534 reviews on it or something like that.
Yeah.
And it's like a 4.3 average, you know, so it's respectable, right? It's respectable.
Oh hell yeah.
And then I cut out and pasted some of the one-star reviews, you know, and, you know, not worth my time and probably no one else's ever, you know, and things like this. And just to tell him and show him, you know, everybody's entitled to their opinion, and some people are going to hate it. And I think there's a difference between, if I read your book and it's not for me, to me, that's a 2 or 3 star review. I didn't dig this, you might, sort of thing, you know. The only thing I think should get a 1 star review is I didn't like it personally, and the execution and the craft and the presentation were horrible.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, somebody photoshopped a cover together in 30 seconds.
Yeah.
And it's full of typos, and it's not even really a story. It's just a bunch of anecdotes. That one I could give a 1 star review to and feel like it was fair.
Yeah.
As a writer, you tend to be more kind to other writers just because, you know, karma may be a thing, right?
I do think that it is. And you're right. Yeah, and I completely agree. There are those that you read and you're like, were you even conscious when you wrote this? But even then, you have to be really angry or mean to just sit down and be vitriolic. People who say, you know, who will rip it to shreds and then go, you know, I only got halfway through it. Then I'm like, okay, well, at least you gave it halfway. Or the people who get three pages in, I go, this is pure crap. I'm like, well, how do you know after three pages? But
yeah, anyway. You could say it didn't grab me.
Yeah.
And I could only make it three pages and decided I didn't want to read it. Sure. But that's a one-star review. I don't know. If it's a one-star review, I tend to just not review it, to be honest with you.
Yeah.
You know, the number of people out there who say, I'd like to write a book someday, you know, 95% of them don't. And this person that you just gave a one-star review to, they're in that 5%. They put themselves out there. And I think you got to respect that a little bit.
Well, let's run down some of your work, because you have the Colin Conway 4-book series. You got the Stefan, and I hope I'm saying this right, Kopriva mystery series.
Perfect.
Thank you. Another series with Jim Wilski, the Bricks and Cam job series with Biegner, a short series with Lawrence Kelter, and I guess a one-off with Bonnie Paulson. Mm-hmm. That is a lot of collaboration. So we're going to circle back around, because I'm kind of fascinated by this. Do you prefer, big picture, do you prefer writing and collaborating with another writer, or do you like it going solo? First part.
Yes. And I'm not trying to be difficult. It is kind of like the patrol detective question from earlier.
Okay.
Like there's, you know, when you're writing a book yourself, you're in total control of everything.
Right.
You can pants it if you want to.
Right.
You can meticulously outline if you want to.
Right.
You want this character to die or go this direction, you can. And so I certainly like playing in my own sandbox all by myself with all my own toys.
Right.
But on the flip side, one of the things about collaboration, to me, the two biggest things that came out of it for me were, one, the drive that you get when you're collaborating. I think just like musicians, when they get together to make music, I think they make, you know, they're more driven even when they're on their own. And I always equate it to, you know, how you might go grab a cup of coffee with another writer or another creative.
Sure.
And you start kicking around whatever you're working on, whatever she's working on, whatever you might work on together, whatever. Here's an idea. Thanks for that idea. Oh, that's cool. All this kind of stuff. You get done with that coffee and you go home and like you want to write like 200,000 words that day. Like you're just so jacked up from it. You're like it just surges your creative energy and creative desire. And when I've collaborated with another writer every single time, to varying degrees. It's been like that throughout the entire project. It's like every time you get something back from the other writer, you get that jolt of energy. And so it speeds things up. It makes it more of that endorphin feeling you get when you create and feel good about it. And the second thing that comes out of it that I think is better than my solo work, and at least initially, is the editing that happens. I mean, we've kind of fallen into a really good process, Colin and I, that by the time we get to the end of the first draft, it's really the second draft. You know, you write something and you hand it to your wife, she's going to spot 15 mistakes that you breezed right over.
Yeah.
And when you're collaborating, you know, 12 of those get found, you know, before either of you gives it to someone else. And if you combine that with, you know, the other writer has great ideas too, and either comes up with one or builds on one that you came up with. And it just, you know, I mean, if I had to pick my best book on a technical level, it would be one of the ones that I've collaborated. I won't say which one, because that would be picking favorites. But I think that the collaboration has brought out the best in me. And so there's that benefit as well.
I was talking to, we had Andrews Wilson on the show a couple of weeks ago, and those guys were doing perfectly well on their own. They got together, they met at Thriller Fest, started writing together, or toying with the idea. I don't remember which one was kicking. I think Wilson was kicking and screaming going, I don't think so, until Andrew said, well, I'll tell you what, let's just give this a shot. And you absolutely hate it. Go on your merry way. And you can even have the story. Well, Wilson had gotten so in love with it, he went through it, and they blew up in a good way. And now they say that they can't ever imagine writing any other way. And that's, they've become known as the household name of Andrews Wilson. So it's so funny. I used one of my favorite phrases. I'm always saying this to my wife, you know, I like, come play in my sandbox, right? So the thing about writing to me, is that I get to create my entire world, the characters, how they speak, the locations, etc. And I'll never forget this one fella came up to me when I had written my very first book, which was a faith-based drama. And he came up and he goes, you know what? Kids would never talk like that. And I went, really? Well, I'll tell you what, why don't you go write a book and you decide how your kids talk, because I hang out with enough kids and these kids are talking that way. So have a nice day. That's the movie, the book that I went on to make a movie out of.
Chasing Grace then?
Yeah, Chasing Grace, which was originally called Discovering Grace. But, you know, I'm one of those guys that I get my hands around something and I just can't let go. And I get a little tenacious about it. And I also do and have made this mistake. I want to know if you have. When self-publishing came around, anybody could write a book and get it up on the store and you're on, you know, Happy Days. And that's good and bad. The good is that it's, we all got to do it. The bad is there's a lot of crap up there. I always figure if you're at least swinging for the fence, if you're out on the field and you're at least swinging, you deserve half the credit, because there are a lot of people that are sitting in the stands going, you know, you kind of suck with that, you know, to be honest with you. Well, why don't you come down here and take a swing? Well, no, I'm not going to take a swing at it. Well, then shut your pie hole. So I like the fact that we're both swinging for it. I was reminded recently when I got one of my, back to the scathing reviews. I'm not sensitive, Frank, not what at all. And somebody's ripping me a new one. And I went, okay, look, you know what? I couldn't afford the edit at the time. So I put my money on the cover. But boy, have I learned the lesson. Talking to KJ too last week, and she said, boy, there's the biggest mistake you can make. And I can see you nodding. Yeah. So if that script isn't, or the book isn't as manuscript as tight as it can possibly be, it just really shouldn't be put out there.
Yeah, and you highlighted a number of the issues for people who are publishing independently. And part of that is competing with the volume that's out there, and how do you get your book noticed?
Yeah.
I mean, it's part of the reason why I'm talking to you right now. You know, somebody hopefully will notice me because of this interview. They'll check out Charlie 316 and then they'll go to Colin's website and they'll go, what? He writes a cozy book for men? What's that about? You know, and go, and it'll, you know, it'll do that. And so in conversations I've had with other writers, a lot of times the analogy comes up that it feels like we're all shouting at a rock concert, you know, trying to be heard, you know, this is my book, you know, and it's difficult. And how you go about it is it's almost an art form in and of itself. And the other part about competing with all that volume out there is exactly what you brought up. And that is that some of what you are competing with is lower quality, but you're being kind of lumped in with it because the platform is the same. The way you got there is the same. So you're absolutely right. I think you have to have a professional cover, and it's worth spending the money on. And you have to make sure that the manuscript is developed and edited. And that's been one of the benefits of the collaboration is even before it goes to someone else, it's been edited by two writers. Right. And Colin and I are brutal about editing. I mean, that's, I think why we get along is that we're just brutal. There's no punches pulled at all and no shorthand, you know, not, you might want to consider blah, blah, blah. It's like, this sucks. You need to fix it. And I mean, I just read his book recently, one of his books, the third one in a series he's going to be releasing, boom, 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 1, 2, 3 here in the spring. And I ripped him for it. I said, there's two huge problems with this. And if you release this like this, it will suck. And here's what they are. But he knows where I'm coming from. Like, he knows I love the character. He knows I love the first two books. I mean, I was brutal about them too. He knows I want him to succeed. He knows I'm not saying this sucks because I want to feel superior to him or something like that. Right. He knows I'm saying it sucks because it does. And I make like suggestions. Here's one way you could fix it, or here's what you need to fix. And here's, you know, my suggestion on how to go about it. And instead of getting all, you know, rubbed wrong by it and butt hurt, you know, for lack of a better term, he thanks me. And I do the same thing when he rips mine, because sure, they're just in the same terrible condition when I send them. And because you're pulling for each other, and it's important that the end, as you're other guest mentioned, the end product has to be quality.
Yeah.
Eventually, I believe that quality rises to the top and people notice it, even if it takes longer because of the volume that's out there. And so if you want to have a shot, you've got to have that quality to start with, because, you know, luck is a big part of it, as you well know.
Oh, yeah.
Luck is a huge part of it. But if luck comes knocking, you know, and you have a ugly cover and a sloppily edited book and an undeveloped story, luck is going to shrug and say, well, you had your chance, you know, and move on.
What's the quote? What is the famous quote about luck? Preparation.
Luck favors a prepared mind.
Yeah, I'll go with that one. That sounds so good. You sound like a professor when you say that. Hey, tell me, I did give a listen to it, but I want to act as though I didn't so that you can tell me all about it. And it's a very clever name. Frank has a podcast called Wrong Place, Right Crime. How long has that been around, and how did it get started, and what's one of your who's one of your favorite guests? So that's a three-parter. Sorry, let's just go.
Okay. That's okay.
I have a short attention span.
It's been around for, I think I debuted it in 2018, early 2018.
Okay.
I'm coming up on 100 episodes.
Wow.
It started out as a monthly gig, and for the first season and a half, it was just monthly. What had happened was Eric Beatner, a friend of mine that you mentioned earlier, he and another guy, Steve Loudon, were doing Writer Types. I don't know if you've heard of Writer Types or not, but it's a great podcast, very upbeat, very quick, very, Eric's an editor by trade, a television editor. So it's just super well produced. Makes mine look like, you know, some idiot with a tape cassette recorder. And it was funny. And so it's almost like an AM morning show kind of vibe to it, right? You know,
sure.
Like the three people sit around and do that. And it really got me excited. I thought that would be fun, and to be able to, you know, reach out and talk to other writers, because I'd been completely retired from law enforcement and from teaching police leadership at that point for about a year. And I was kind of being a hermit, and the idea of having a connection like you and I are having now, being able to reach out to other writers and stuff,
right,
was very attractive. But I couldn't copy them, you know, I mean, copycat, that's not going to work. So I thought, what could I do with my limited skills, you know, that would work. And I was struck by that FM dial, old style. You're driving a car late at night, it's raining, the wipers are going back and forth, you hit this station, and it's just a guy talking to somebody else, and you recognize the guest, and, oh, I read that book that she wrote. And then they're talking about the book, but then maybe they go on, they talk about religion a little bit, and then they're talking about baseball, and then they're talking about pie, and then they're back to the book, and it's all, you know, they're talking about the craft, and it's just really deep, sort of 1 hour long. And I thought, I can do that. I can talk like nobody's business, and
sure,
I can get them talk. And so I started out doing it that way on a monthly basis, about a 1 hour episode. And my wife is the one who came up with the title, which was, so she said it, I was like, that's it. That's perfect. What ended up going on though, was I enjoyed it too much.
Yeah.
But editing a 1 hour podcast weekly was not going to work. I wouldn't be doing any writing if I did that. So I went to a weekly open and shut episode, which is about 15 to 20 minutes long. And that allowed me to get other writers on more frequently, make more connections, highlight more writers, talk about more writers, but still have time to write myself. And so now there's a feature episode once a month, and then there's an open and shut episode the other weeks of the month, from September to June every year is the seasons. And you know, we talk you know, on the open and shuts, we get pretty quick into, hey, David, who are you?
Yeah.
Tell me about your book. Tell me a little bit something else to make people be interested, and now we got to go. Whereas on the feature episode, we do a deeper dive. Oh, my favorite. I got to interview Eric Van Lustbader, who wrote, you wrote a lot of the Bourne books after Robert Ludlum passed on.
Yeah.
And he also wrote The Ninja and that series that came out in the 80s. That was pretty huge. And so, like, that's somebody I read when I was 15 and loved the books and stuff. And so that was pretty cool.
Awesome. Well, you know, and that makes me think of something. You write under two different pen names, Frank Scalise, which you and I had this conversation about, that is the coolest last name ever. I told my wife last night, I said, hey, Frank's going to be on the show tomorrow. And I'm like, I'm going to steal his real name as a character for one of my books. So you're using Frank Scalise for mainstream fiction, which includes a novel and children's series about hockey, which I know you're a big fan. I want to go down to that path in a second. And Frank Saverio for fantasy?
Yeah, that hasn't gotten very far yet. I just kind of am laying the foundations for that. But I'm going to be writing a fantasy book or series. It depends on how the first part, if it's a book or if it's a novella.
And I have read somewhere that you also have a third one you're thinking about, Francis Sexy Kitten. You're going to write romance? Is that true?
I think you need to not believe everything you read on the internet or
the back of your... Francis Sexy Kitten. Yeah. Okay.
I'm going to use that now. So
here's something I've been thinking about lately, and it's a great deal about thinking about what concerns authors, what they write about in relationship to what they're doing. So I know it's super logical for you to say, well, I worked as a detective and a police officer, so I'm going to write about crime. Do you think you would have written about the world of crime if you hadn't worked in the field?
Yeah, I do. I do. Growing up, I always identified as a writer, like I said, kind of the same way a musician might identify as a musician or something. Right. But when I thought about what I might want to do, I always thought about being a police officer, lawyer, or a teacher. Those were the three things that kind of were on my mind as I was a teenager and then became a young man. And after I got out of the service, I needed a job pretty quick. You know, I mean, I had a wife and a son and I looked at those three options and, you know, 7 years is it to become a lawyer?
Yeah.
And 4 years plus to become a teacher. And I already had enough credits, had about a year and a half or so of college credit from courses I took in the military to qualify to apply to the police job. So that's the way that I went there. But I think I probably would have primarily written fantasy if I had not had the experience of coming on to the job.
Piggybacking on that, do you think there's a genre or a subject matter that you see yourself writing that has little to do with crime? I mean, and besides the fantasy, and I do know, inserting this, that you did try your hand at a little erotic crime fiction, which I didn't even know that there was a genre, Mr. Man.
Well, that's a little bit of a misnomer, although it is the subtitle that I used on a...
Yes, you did. I'm quoting you.
I'm being hoisted on my own petard. Despite the fact that I write crime fiction, and it is, a lot of it is grittier, not all of it, but some of it is on the grittier, darker end of the spectrum. Most of my work, the graphic parts were violence and language. There wasn't really any graphic sexual content. And there's a few reasons for that. Part of the reason is let's face it, sex is hard to write. It's hard to write well. A fight scene is a lot easier to write well. And secondly, I've always kind of been of the mind that outside of erotica, I guess, the less you write about sex, the better it is and the better it looks, you know, the better, more exciting it is, because a little goes a long way in terms of what you're showing the reader. But I did write three short stories. Sex was a very central theme. And eventually I thought, hey, you know, there's one of those is really long and there's three of them. I could package those together in a three book, like novella length product and put it out. And that's what I did. And I just, so they're all in one place. And but I don't know if I did a good job of writing the sex or not, but you know, it needed to be written that way. And that doesn't happen very often. Most of the time I can have a kiss and a caress and a door close. And I'm perfectly content with that. Even if people are getting shot in the head in other parts of the story.
Oh my God. You do like the novella and you like the anthology series, which leads me to a grifter song, which first of all, I think it's a really super cool title. Second of all, I have a very specific idea in mind after you explain to my listeners what makes this series unique and where you see them going in the future. This is the anthology Grifter Song, and it's a collaboration, isn't it?
Yeah, it's pretty cool, actually. And I haven't seen it really done a lot. I'm not going to say I came up with it. There's no new ideas under the sun. And so a grifter song is it's a serial novella anthology series in which follows a couple, Sam and Rachel, who are grifters. They're con artists. They love each other very deeply and really not much of the rest of the world. The rest of the world's either a mark or a cohort, and that's about it. Originally, I thought it would be cool to write a novella called The Concrete Smile. I had a pretty good idea what it was going to be about. And then maybe write another one every quarter or so and release them and just kind of have a series just as another line in the water for readers. I had a conversation with a guy named Gary Phillips, who is a great writer, and he dabbles pretty heavily in the comic book and graphic novel field. But anyway, he was putting together a series that was also a novella series, but it was anthology in nature, and it was going to be a different author for every installment and released at the beginning of each month over a 6-month period. And as soon as I saw that format, I was like, oh, that's what this needs to be. This absolutely needs to be that. And so that's how Grifter Song kind of became fully formed. So now I wrote the first episode, and another writer picked up in episode 2. And each of these episodes are completely self-inclusive. The con that you read about is completed, whether successfully, partially successfully, or failed. Any one of them is a standalone, but they always have the same characters. They may be in a different city, obviously different writer and a different writing style, a different point of view. One might be, mine was Sam in the first person. Other people might write Rachel in the third, or the Mark in first person, or something else, or multi-viewpoints. It just differs. And so we're about ready to head into season 3 now. So there's been 2 seasons with different authors doing this, and it's been really cool. I edit the series, and so I get to work with each author, and it's just, it's been really fun. It's been really cool. And this upcoming season is probably the most diverse in terms of the authors participating, both in terms of their background and their styles.
And just to make sure I'm crystal clear, you said season 3 is coming up.
January. Yeah, January 1st is when episode 13 by Matt Phillips, called A Rule of Thirds, will drop.
First of all, I liked your artist so much. Zach McCain, he's got the eye, man. That I reached out to him. I was like, dude, I don't want to copy his stuff, but I like your style, and that is really super fresh.
Yeah, he did the covers for the Blood on Blood. And the all of the Anya books that I wrote with Jim Wilski. Very fast worker, very nice guy, very humble. Just, I can't say enough good things about him.
Have you been approached by anybody about something to do with this series?
No, not directly. It's interesting that you say that, though, because a lot of people have said, wow, this would work really good as like a Netflix series or, short run, 6-episode season sort of thing on HBO or whatever. And when we thought of the idea, that was sort of the model of it was considered as, is like, this is going to be like a Netflix short run series. And there's actually a subscription model to the series. If you subscribe to the series as a whole, you get a price break, and you get a bonus subscriber only episode. And so there's a benefit to subscribing to all 6 of the episodes within the season. And those bonus episodes, I wrote those and I made sure they weren't throwaways. Oh, Sam and Rachel go to the zoo. They're integrated into the season that they're the bonus for. And
okay, we're gonna I told you it'd be an hour. I'm a little bit over, so let me just bang out a couple of quick more things, getting down to some nitty-gritty, especially for a lot of my listeners are writers, and they like their writing process and the creative process and so forth. And I would love to know, just because we just love to know each other's routine. With this many books, you've got to have some kind of discipline. You said earlier at the beginning of the show that I don't really do that. But I'm like, you know what? You have to. You have to have some kind of form of discipline to be able to do this, to be as prolific. So I want to know, what's that routine like? And then I'm going to give you one more part of that second thing. And that is, do you have an average word count a day that you like to shoot for?
For the second part, the answer is not really. I kind of play that by feel, and so it could be a moving target. Some days I may feel like I'm really struggling today, and oh, look, I got 1800 words. Other times when I was writing the Charlie 316 series with Colin, I mean, we banged out a 100,000 word novel in 3 weeks.
Whoa.
First, for, first draft. Don't get me wrong. Rough. It's a first draft. Yeah. But I was writing, it's that energy I was talking about earlier. I'd get back the chapter from him, and when I got to my section of the next part to write, I'd be at my desk for hours. I'd write 5,000-6,000 words that day.
Wow.
And now that's extreme. I'm not saying I do that on my own every day by any stretch. I don't think I'm OCD, but I am kind of a little bit compulsive in some ways, in that I'm a focuser. Like if I find a new computer game I really like, you know, I'm playing that game only, and I'm diving into it. If I find a series, we've been watching a series called Travelers on Netflix recently, and we're binging 5-6 episodes a day sometimes, you know, at least three or four.
Look at you. You
know, and that's kind of how I write too. So like if I'm on a project, I'm pushing hard. And so that 1800 word count might be plenty. So it's not very disciplined. It's more obsessive, I guess. Or it's more compulsive.
But come on, here's my more important question, especially as it pertains to your binging. What are you eating while you're binging? Because this is key. You got to be a professional. The snack. What's the snack?
You know, I'm not a huge snacker while watching TV, to be honest with you.
Wow.
And been doing some like more rigid meal stuff, trying to lose some COVID weight here.
Yeah.
And so, I've been eating a little bit more prescribed food. Crackers are good, like Wheat Thins, that kind of stuff.
Oh,
you know?
Boring.
Kind of boring. But, you know, hey, I'm all about watching the show. That's what it's about.
For me, so. I'm with you. Mine is kettle corn. Yeah, I'm now completely obsessed. It's ridiculous.
So maybe you're an obsessive compulsive.
I am.
Creative stuff is concerned.
Yeah. And my COVID weight, you can strike it up to a craft beer. Of course, we live in craft beer country, San Diego.
Sure. I was down in San Diego for Left Coast Crime back in March. And I was super excited because I've hardly ever been there, only through the airport, basically. And I was excited to visit. I was really looking forward to it. And then after day one, they canceled the conference. I had to fly home because they were, you know, COVID was going crazy in the middle of March there.
Anyway, next time you're down here.
My wife hates winter. Hates cold. She hates being cold. And just 2 days ago, she said, "Hey, it's freezing cold out. It's windy as heck." And she just walked over to me and she said, "You know, it's 71 and calm in San Diego right now."
Yeah.
"Are you suggesting a move there, babe, or what?" You know, she's like, "No, I just thought you should know."
Yeah. Dude, you come down, I'll take you out for craft beer and we'll talk about writing. How about that?
It sounds like a good idea. I'm there.
I love it. As we close up, I got two questions here. All right, best piece of advice with now 30 books under your belt, 30 plus, 52 pen names, anthology series out the wazoo. What is the best piece of advice you would give a writer today?
Well, in David's style, it's two parts. First off, I would say, believe you can do it.
Yeah.
Don't let, you know, you're going to have plenty of doubt, but don't let that stop you. There's no such thing as writer's block. Just, you know, there might be sucky writing, but there's no writer's block.
Yeah.
Right. So believe you can do it. And then secondly, do the work. I don't just mean putting the words on paper, but learning the craft, being a reader, talking to other writers and learning from other writers, and all of the things that go along with learning the craft, you know, do the work. But I think if you believe you can do it and you do the work, you combine those two elements, you can end up with a quality book.
Yeah, perfect, dude. My last question, this is on my personal thing. If you were not a writer, which would you prefer, A or B? Real easy. Would you rather be, if you could snap your fingers and come back in the next 10 minutes as a rock star playing the guitar or a hockey player playing the puck?
Oh, I thought it was going to be easy. I was about to reach for my acoustic guitar over here that I play very poorly and hold it up and vote rock star. And then you said hockey player. Oh, my God. Oh, my goodness. Oh, that's the hardest question you've asked me. Do you realize that?
Thank you.
I would play hockey. And the only reason, I think, is because the team sport aspect of that is just, you'd make so many good friends and you'd experience that unity and that togetherness. Gosh, being a rock star, there's a lot more pitfalls when it comes, a lot more dangers there.
Yeah.
And you could always play guitar, when you're not at the rink, you know.
Yeah. So. It's funny. Wife and I watched the Bee Gees documentary last night. And
was that good?
Oh, it was stunning.
I want to watch that.
I have played their music for most of my career, and I was always a big fan, but I gained a whole new appreciation about just their level of artistry. That's a good answer, though. And I got to tell you, folks, Frank Zafiro, so Frank, ZAFIRO.com. Go to his website, check it out. There, you'll spend entirely too much time on his website, just like I did. Frank, thanks so much for spending time with me. This is so cool.
Oh, thanks for having me. It's been great. I really enjoyed it.
Hey, folks, thank you so much for joining me and Frank Zafiro on today's Naked Monday. We'll see you next time.
This is Frank Zafiro, and you are listening to Naked Monday with David Temple.
Oh, that is so sexy.